everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and you are tuned in for episode 192, and I'm very, very happy and pleased to welcome back to the Cave one of my favorite all-time guests and favorite people in the comic book industry. I know I say that to just about everybody, but the people who I get on the show, I do really want to like them as people. And this guest, we've had him before, and I'm going to have him plenty of times in the future, and that's the uncouth one himself, Mr. Mike Ruth. So, of course, with all of the crazy things that are happening in the world, a lot of the people who I would normally be able to see and reconnect with and chat with at our comic book shows, the Toronto Comic Con or the TCAF that is usually scheduled in May, we won't be able to do that this year. So it's a good opportunity now to use social media in a good, responsible way to reconnect with the people who we consider our friends and acquaintances and people that we meet through this hobby of ours, to have a chit chat with them, see how they're doing, and to just give each other a little bit of good content to discuss the current state of, you know, whatever is going on in our minds, the world, comic books. Mike's got a lot of cool things that he's got on the go as far as covers that he's drawing, and he had a tour that was lined up for this summer going across Canada that unfortunately has to be either canceled or postponed. So we talk about that a little bit, as well as the Kickstarter that he's going to have launched very soon for Dodge that he's working on with Matt Nixon. So all of these things we get into. And of course, Mike, similar to my previous guest, Sean Daly, is a very, very big wrestling fan. So we get into some good old-fashioned wrestling talk that he gets really excited about. And I love talking wrestling with these guys as well, being a wrestling fan from my young childhood. So we get into all of that. It's a really fun conversation. I hope everybody enjoys it. So without further ado, here's Mike Ruth on the Cave of Solitude. So we are happy to have back in the Cave of Solitude the uncouth Mr. Mike Ruth. Welcome back to the show, Mike. How are you doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
We've been planning this for quite some time, and it's always better. I feel you're one of the people that I prefer talking to in person. So we're having to resort to Skype due to all of the nonsense that's happening in the world right now. But nonetheless, it's really nice to be able to get together and have a chat, a little sit down and catch up.
Oh, for sure, man. I always look forward to chatting with you at the shows.
Yeah.
For sure.
How are you and Erica doing? How are you guys holding up?
Yeah, we're doing all right. Erica is unbelievable. She's been kind of preparing, you know, everything, like doing everything, basically. Like, I'm sure I would be dead by now if it wasn't for her at this point. The last month or so, she's just been on top of everything. And, you know, we share a common area in the building, and she's constantly wiping that down because, you know, there's like lots of people coming in and out, and we're both adhering to our national and provincial mandate and trying to stay inside and only go out for absolute necessities. And, you know, in our case, that's just getting food, medicine, and, you know, mailing our goods, like mailing our art and Erica's jewelry out is like, that's our only way to do it now because there's no more conventions. She actually had a really big show in the summertime, which we haven't got the official word if it's going to be canceled yet, but it's a big 4-day outdoor show that she was really looking forward to and working hard to prepare for. And we have to assume now that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be shut down. So it's just, you know, just doing some rejigging and figuring out how to piece what's left together. This year is a little tricky for us, for me, I guess, just because I had a whole tour laid out. I was going all across Canada this year, yeah, touring with some books, and that's all been shut down. Today we just got the official word. I've known for a couple of days, but we got the official word today that the East Coast Comic Expo is canceling this year. You know, rather than try to rebook it, they're just canceling. I think deep down everyone knows that that's probably going to be the fate of just about every show, at least until we get a better grip on what's going on. So yeah, man, it's a big adjustment. I like to think that we're mentally well prepared for this because we're both kind of used to freelancing. You know, we're used to the uncertainty of living as artists. So I think in our minds, in our bodies, we're fairly well prepared for whatever it is to come. We're well supplied, and we miss our families. That's the main thing. My family doesn't use any technology, so I don't have any way to Skype with my parents or to see them. But Erica has a Zoom meeting with her folks every week, and that's become a very big part of our week now. So it's just a new reality, man. We're just all getting used to it, and I don't think any of us really know the size and scope of it yet. So
yeah, and it seems like every day the information that we're getting or how to proceed, like, you know, you hear the same recommendations, and after a while you need a little bit more clarity, because what they keep telling you just sort of sounds like the same jargon, and it's like you become numb to it a little bit, right?
Well, there's a lot of information that I think if they let everyone know what was really going down, I think there'd be mad panics. I think there'd be a lot of chaos and a lot of rioting, because I think this disease or this illness is something that is caught much more easily than we think. You know, I think those you know, those types of things, it's hard to say, but you know, it's scary. It's just best to avoid people, and you know, best to avoid contact with anybody. It's just tough, you know, like, especially our parents are older, and both my brothers are working still. They're both considered essential. So it's all very kind of scary and weird right now.
What do your brothers do for work, if you don't mind me asking?
My older brother's a locator, so he's always having to, you know, basically locating pipes and wires and things underground for construction and for people who, he's literally the guy that shows up when the call before you dig, you know, kind of thing. So he's doing location work, and that's fairly crucial. And my younger brother works in a factory that assembles heaters and coolers, I think. So it's I guess they've been deemed essential to some degree. So he's still there. I think it's a reduced staff, but he's still there, and he's still doing his thing there. So it's just I wish everyone was at home, but I get why we, you know, why some people can't be. I just think there's a lot of so-called essential businesses that are open that shouldn't be open, in my opinion. But you know, that's all right. It's up for debate, I guess.
Yeah, so. I've been telling everybody that I talk to, because my line of work is in the construction field, but not in the field of building hospitals or doing maintenance work. It's, you know, high-rise condominiums, residential kind of stuff, and I think everyone's kind of, so there's some people who, in my field of work, that'll go to work with the virus. That's just their mentality, because they're stupid idiots.
Yeah.
And when you work with that type of a culture, sometimes you're even more paranoid, because we always work sick, you know?
Yeah.
And
for
you,
sure.
And you deal with the reality of where this is a construction site. It is what it is. You're not expecting to have the same amenities that you have working in an office or in a school. So now when there's this huge paranoia, you're like, I don't know if I want to be here, because we all have older parents now. We're not
sure.
You don't want to be the reason why you can't either visit them or get anyone in your family sick, right? So there is that big debate still going on. So I'm going back to work on next week, which would be the 7th, the Tuesday. But now there's lots of talks of more things that are considered quote unquote essential being shut down. You don't know where you fall into that.
Right, it's hard to plan. It's crazy, man. There's just a lot of stores that are opening that I'm kind of like, how is that essential? How is this essential? But, you know, I guess it's essential to somebody somewhere. I don't, like, for instance, I don't think the brick should be considered essential. I don't know, unless it's hospitals going in there to buy beds every day. I can't really see the necessity of getting a new dresser carpet.
Yeah,
I don't really see how that's a thing that's worth risking your life over.
I think the reason those places get that exemption, because I said to my wife, I'm like, why is that open? She's like, well, they sell you know, washing machines and appliances mm-hmm. for the house that are essential. Like stoves or stuff like that. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess. But
I would imagine places like that are selling a lot of big deep freezers and stuff like that now, because exactly. People are hoarding meat and hoarding stuff right now, which I think should be punishable, frankly, and hopefully will be. You know, the stores are getting restocked, you know. Like, I know things are selling out, and it's because people are reacting so strongly and feeling the need, like, to do this. But unless there's a bigger disruption to the supply chain, and that could be coming, we don't know. But, you know, I don't think North America in general handled this or got on this as quickly as they should have. I I can't criticize any particular leg of the government more than the other, because I think there's sort of, you know, I don't even want to call them failures. I think there's just bad decisions made out of poor information. And as more information comes, hindsight's becoming clearer. You know, they'll probably if they had shut the border, you know, a few weeks earlier, we could have avoided a lot of this trouble. I mean, you just have to look at what's happening in New York City right now. And my heart goes out to everyone in that city, because that is just... I saw a photo someone posted the other day. One of my customers posted the other day. It was a photo of the Javits Center now and the Javits Center, you know, 6 months ago during Comic-Con. And, you know, you see the one photo, it's just, you know, booming colors and tables and booths and fans. And then the other one, it's just hospital tents in the same space. And it's just kind of a staggering picture. So yeah, man, I don't think we really know. All I can tell you is I have some friends overseas who have been in quarantine for a long time now in Asia, and they're saying it's working. Like, they're like, you know, people are starting to be able to come outside. Like, it took 2 or 3 months of total quarantine, but they've had fantastic results in places like Hong Kong and Singapore, where, you know, they've I'm not saying it's been eradicated, but it's certainly been slowed down to the point where people are starting to get back and factories are starting to open up again, and the sky is turning that delightful shade of brown again, you know, from the pollution. But, you know, it's I don't know, man, it's such a strange time. I think the earth, you know, is taking a bit of a breather when these places shut down. I think, you know, you see the water becoming more clear and the air becoming more clear. And I think that maybe there'll be some data that comes back from this whole experience that suggests that going forward, maybe we should have, you know, mandatory total shutdowns for a couple of days per month, just to let the energy and resources catch their breath. You know, they've already got the numbers on what Earth Day does, and that's just one day a year. You can power the city of Toronto for a year on the energy they save on Earth Day in Ontario alone. So, you know, you start to think of it in terms like that. I think that there's big changes that could be made that could, you know, not only fix the problem, but, you know, it'll hurt the pocketbooks. But we're looking at the results of not dealing with the issue soon enough, hurting everyone's pocketbooks now.
Yeah, exactly. I think we need to get over that. We this side, I mean, every part of the world, but North America has... We've built ourselves up to such a level of entitlement
that
anything that impedes on our conveniences is draconian, and it's socialist, and it's every bad, you know, possible thing you can imagine, and it's a conspiracy.
Every bad angle, yeah. It's for sure. But you know what? You know, you say that, and at the same time, you know, there's still people gathering in groups. There's still people hosting parties. There's people who are doing it in total defiance of this virus. And the longer these types of things are happening, the more the irresponsible few decide to exercise their maximum rights, the less rights we're all going to end up with, and less freedom we're going to end up with. I mean, you know, you want to have martial law in this country? You get that by gathering in groups and disregarding the national mandate to stay home and be safe and don't touch anybody. But there's people out there in direct defiance of it. I mean, Erica and I went for a walk in the sun yesterday and saw, like, you know, 3 or 4 guys hitting a bong, just walking down the street sharing a bong. And I just shook my head like, what are you guys doing? Like, what are you guys doing? You know, like, it's just bananas to me. But, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. Folks are going to folks, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what you learn is, in this life, the only way we bring about change is if we do it individually, and we make responsible decisions one at a time, and hopefully everybody individually takes certain things seriously and has courtesy for other people. That's the only way. I mean, it's so hard to gauge right now, and you're learning a lot too about social behavior and how much that might change when this is all said and done. But, you know, you hear the mixed message of go out for a walk, stay inside by all means. I think you've got to be that fine line of, listen, playgrounds, places where people congregate to play soccer and baseball and these types of things, we got to shut those down to discourage all of that. But as far as, like, being able to go to the park and get in some fresh air, we usually keep our distance anyways when we go to parks, you know, shut down maybe the public restrooms because you don't want those things being shared. But getting out there and enjoying the sun will definitely mentally help us to get back inside and you know, bunker up for the rest of the day.
Well, that's the thing that I missed the most. Like, Erica and I would hike two or three times a week in Bronte Park, Bronte Provincial Park. And I understand why they've closed the provincial parks, but I could kind of see why they would close the tuck shops and the offices and the information booths and the eating areas and the bathrooms, even the porta-johnnies. Sure. But, like, the miles and miles of open trail and the fields and the hectares of woods that we would hike through just for our own sense of sanity, you know, we're not able to do that now. And I guess it's because they can't police those areas, if that's the case. People go there and have giant, you know, outdoor orgies or parties or whatever they do. But, like, I think, you know, without really having anyone seeing, you know, what's going on, I think people would certainly abuse it. I would just use it to walk. I would literally just use it to walk. And we hardly see a soul in that place when we go to the park anyway. Like, it's just a nice, quiet place away from the city. And, I mean, it's right off the highway, but for a moment you forget that, you know, you get deep enough in the valley and you know, in the woods, and you forget that you're even in the city. Yeah. And you can let yourself go and relax, and you know,
it's so healthy.
I miss that a lot. I really do, and I wish there was some more trails around here that were kind of just long unbroken trails. But you know, in Oakville here, everyone's backyard goes right to the lake, so there's only a few areas where you can really do a nice walk around on the lake, you know, and you end up having to loop it a couple times to get some, you know, a decent walk in, you know. But you know, this is a new reality. Yeah, we gotta just make do with it, you know.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know how much of that shutting, especially if you live in Toronto. Like, I didn't think about it because I live just outside of the city. So yeah. I can walk through the neighborhoods and the houses. It's not a park, but me and my wife and the dog can go for a good hour-long walk. But if you're in the city and all the places that you would maybe walk through, trails, if you're by the harbor front or all these things that give you that sense of nature or just that little bit of escape from the concrete, if that's all shut down, these people are going to be more and more and more get that cabin fever. Which I think is just going to make people act out even more to an extent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so I think so. The more freedoms you take away, the more people buck against that. But, you know, I think if people just accepted the fact that this is a serious situation, and if we all were able to get on the same page in how we behave and how we distance ourselves and you know, the wearing of masks and all these things that are now required, you know, I feel like if we could all get kind of on the same page, we could beat this thing, and maybe Comic-Cons would come back. But between you and me, I don't think we're going to have any Comic-Cons in 2020, period. I really hope that's not the case, because I had an entire tour laid out. I'm still waiting for feedback on three or four shows in the fall that haven't said one way or the other, because I think there's not enough information to make that call yet. But all my spring shows are gone, and even shows that I had lined up in June and July are making announcements. So yeah, it's brutal, man. But you know, it's necessary. You know, we can't do this. We can't do things the way we've been doing it and expect to beat this thing. It's weird, man. It's unprecedented. No one in our lifetime has ever experienced anything quite like this to this degree.
Yeah, it's that one word that keeps being said, but I don't think it's a cliche. It really is unprecedented.
It is, sure.
I hope after this is all said and done, I said to my wife, I'm like, you know, maybe it would be good 1 month every year for different countries or sections of the world to do a kind of shutdown like this, where we allow the planet to heal itself.
Yes, I think I think we're going to get some incredible data back on that, and I think it's going to blow people's minds because, you know, think about how many times you're driving at night and you see these huge, you know, shopping centers or big box plazas with all the lights on and all the outdoor signage and all the floodlights in the parking lot on and all this energy burning to no avail because the stores are all closed, and it blows my mind that that's just thousands and thousands of dollars in energy per shop that are being wasted every month for no reason. We can switch off. You know what? It'd be nice to see the stars again. It'd be nice to turn the shit off at night. Sorry, I don't want to swear. It'd be nice to turn the lights off and be able to see the stars. Yeah. I still remember the blackout we had, whatever it was, 15 or more years ago. The blackout, we only lost power for a day. But that night, I never saw stars like that in my life, you know, in Ontario. So, yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping we learn from this, because there are so many things that we see as necessity that are really just conveniences that we could do without.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And it absolutely would be nice to...
Well, and I think too, just from a person-to-person level, I think that, you know, those who are used to a certain amount and now have that amount reduced by half or less than half or in some cases down to nothing, I'm hoping that's going to give some people perspective on how other people live normally every day. You know, I think there's big divides in wealth and big divides in people's status in this country. And I think that people don't really get it when you're, you know, perhaps a low income artist or a low income creator of some kind. And, you know, there's this illusion that because you draw comic books, everyone thinks you live like a rock star and you take a limousine everywhere you go. And it could not be further from the truth. And I think that people who are used to a higher end lifestyle, who've had that stricken away, will maybe have a little bit more empathy and appreciation for people who just have never had that and never will, or you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so I'm
totally
hoping it's going to make us closer together through a sense of understanding, and it'll eliminate that sense of competition or that sense of status that some of us hold on to so tightly, you know.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, we don't sometimes put ourselves in other people's shoes because our comforts become normal, and we still try to find, you know, they say when there's absence of oppression, people will still find it. They'll still find something to feel that way about. So, yeah,
for sure,
it's definitely a wake up call. And I mean, for myself, I'm a people person, but I'm an introvert by nature. I like my quiet time, my lonely time to read, to watch movies. I enjoy being together with people, but never large groups, even though I love comic cons and stuff. So even someone like yourself, who's a creator, and a lot of your life, you've trained your whole life for having to bunker down and stay inside. So I can cope with it. I'm okay with that. It's just more the sad reality that everyone's having to do this because of a scare.
Yes. Humans, if humans are good at one thing in this life, they're good at learning things the hard way. And unfortunately, I think we're learning a real big lesson the hard way right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. So how have you, how's your creative process been during this time? Has it been affected at all, or is it, you know, you're still plugging away?
I think so, man. I think there's a heaviness right now that is hard to shake. And I find what's happening with me, and I'm being totally honest, like if I'm sitting and drawing and I'm starting to struggle, it feels like a way bigger struggle than it does on regular days when I struggle. It just, I don't know, like I'm having a hard time letting go and being creative, like, you know, doing sketch requests or doing commission requests where it's like, draw me this character or draw this character fighting this character, like that doesn't require a whole lot of brain power. But when I'm given something like, hey, you know, I want you to do a cover for my comic book and it's about this, and I'm going to send you the script, and, you know, I start to get into the script and I love the story, but I'm finding a hard time crossing the bridge to actually be able to make that into reality on the page. I feel like there's some part of my creativity that's afraid to come out, or it's hiding, or it's just been battered down by the reality right now. So I've been trying to just kind of knock out a sketch cover or two per day. I have a long list of orders that I actually now have the time to do. I had a long standing order, about a 2-year-old request, for that huge poker game piece, which you may have seen me post on Instagram or Facebook recently. It's a bunch of superheroes from Marvel and DC in a poker, Tony Stark's poker den. And it was a piece that was commissioned long ago, but I knew it would take me a week to do it. And I finally had that week suddenly available. So I've been trying to going back on my old list and trying to tackle some old projects and breathe some life into those. And then, yeah, I mean, in the meantime, just taking on some smaller stuff. And yeah, I got a couple of comic book covers to draw this month for some creators I'm really excited about, but I just can't seem to find the hook that I want yet. And I think it's just because I'm still getting my wheels under me this month and just figuring out how the new way of working is going to be. Partially because I don't have that release of just being able to pick up and go for a walk. I mean, in this line of work, when you're sitting and drawing all day, if you don't get up and move every 10 minutes or every 15 minutes, you know, you can start to hurt your back and, you know, really get into a bad shape with your knees and whatever. I sit really weird in my chair when I'm drawing, like my feet kind of curl up under me like a goat. And so I have really short hamstrings and really short Achilles tendons from years of sitting. So I try to get up and walk, but now it's just weird going out to walk, you know, it's just going out like, yeah, it's just strange now. And so, yeah, I think I got off track there, but creatively, I think I'm still doing what I do. I just, it just feels a little heavier now, you know?
Yeah. And I know for a lot of you guys, well, all of you guys that may not be writing a monthly book for the big two, the cons are a big revenue stream for you guys. And yeah, it's also a way for you guys to be in contact with your fellow creators, your peers, the fans. Yeah. It's a good time for you guys too. As much as it's revenue stream, it's also good for the energy that goes back into the work. So,
That's it. It's when I'm at a Comic-Con, that's me as the best version of myself, because I'm, you know, Comic-Cons are part performance, it's part instructional, it's part it's community, and you're connecting with new fans, you're connecting with old fans, you're building other people's collections of artwork, you're introducing new comics to people, it's just the whole exchange is what it's all about. I haven't put a lot of stroke into what I'm going to earn at each show, because it's anyone's game nowadays. I think the last couple of years have been really tough at Comic Cons. I'm hearing creators all around saying they're not making anywhere near the money they used to, and they're not sure if it's their own comics that they're trying to sell or just the fact that no one's got any money in it. And I think it's the latter half of that. I know for me, I've barely been doing any touring except for local shows in the past couple of years, because it's just not financially viable once you factor in the plane tickets and the hotel. I mean, I'm never going to make that money back, but I still do those shows knowing this, because it is the only sense of community that you get in this industry. The only way to connect with your friends who also draw and write comics. It's the only way to connect those fans and that you only see when you're in Saskatoon, or you only see when you're in Buffalo or wherever you're at. So it's tough, man. It's I'm hoping to change things up a little bit and replace some of the feelings that I get from Comic Cons that I'll miss by going on. Maybe I got a Twitch account started, and I want to start doing some more live streaming stuff, because it's fun, and I feel like I can still answer questions and do all the stuff that I love to do at Comic Cons. But yeah, financially, it's a massive hit too, because this year in particular, because we had a huge tour planned, and we had the Jenica TMNT book, and we have the Conan book that I just did a cover for, the Sumerian book rather, for Ablaze Publishing for Red Nails. And, a couple of Archie books and things like this that we were sitting on that were supposed to be launched at particular shows that just aren't happening now. And, lots of money went into signage and equipment and all these things for the tour that are just, it's hard. And it's hard to, the online sales have been pretty good, but it's hard to sell books online because of the high cost of shipping. And it just changes the whole dynamic of what we're doing here. And we had big plans. So now we're in that kind of like, okay, so what do we do kind of mode. But I don't think anyone knows what to do just yet. So we're still waiting to see how this thing pans out, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big hit for me. So, luckily I've over the years been able to build up a good relationship with a lot of friends and fans who regularly get pieces from me. And many of them had reached out to me and hooked up commissions that they would have got at a show. I'm so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful to all of them for doing that, because yeah, it's going to keep bread on the table for a little while,
Yeah. And it may be for some of those places that you would have to travel to, the travel cost is maybe no longer an issue, and you can still get all those commissions done for the people who are planning to see you.
Yes, yeah. I don't hopefully. Know how much. I mean, and some people are holding out hope that the shows are still going to run. So I'm still doing pre-orders where I can. If there's a show that's like they rescheduled Calgary to July now, and I was looking forward to going to Calgary, because it's been about 5 years since I was there last, and I've got lots of friends out there. So I mean, it remains to be seen if it will actually run in July now, but I hope it does. I mean, I'll go if it's running, but I if I'm honest with you, I don't think any of these shows are going to run in the summertime. I'd be honestly surprised if anything ran before Fan Expo at this point, if Fan Expo even runs. Yeah. And I'm not saying that to be doom and gloom. I'm just I'm addressing and eating a new reality every day.
Yeah.
And I have to be prepared for the worst, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was a little worried when I spoke to Kevin Boyd just a week before Toronto Comic Con, and it was still up and running. Everything was, all systems were a go. And my wife was starting to say, you know, I don't know if you should go next week, even if it's still going to happen. It could be very risky. And I'm like, you know, maybe you're right, but I'm gonna see if it's still happening. I'm gonna give it a shot. But now, with the way that you see things are going and how serious it can get real fast, even for us, we're nowhere near what some of these other places are like. I'm very grateful for that. And I think because we're handling it well, but I'm still thinking to myself, I don't even know if Fan Expo were to happen, if it would be a good idea to go.
Well, that's just it, because the way this virus works, it comes in waves, right? So you might, the numbers rate down and then have a massive event where 100,000 people attend, and then you're suddenly right back where you were.
You never know.
And no one knows who's got it. No one knows who's carrying it. There's people who carried it and passed it on without ever showing a symptom. I mean, it's just a fact. So it's, you know, it's really tough. It's an invisible enemy at this point. And I think the smart decision would just be to cancel all shows for 2020 until we really know what's going on. Yeah. And as much as that sucks for everybody, and as much as that's a huge financial hardship for everybody, I mean, you know, it's not just comics. Comics are a wonderful luxury in a lot of people's lives. It's my livelihood, but for other people, it's a hobby. And there's much more, I hate to say it, but there's much more pressing things than our entertainment right now. And I think, unfortunately, the worst is yet to come, and we're going to see that. I don't want to be all doom and gloom, but man, this is some scary stuff going on. And you know, it's it helps you see the priority of things much more clearly, I think.
Yeah. And I think there is a lot more pressing things that are important. We got to keep we got to be realistic about that. All the things sometimes that we place so much value on, you start to realize, like, well, we can figure out a way around that, can't we? When things really get tough. But it's also, I think, very important at this time to appreciate the artists and the creators, because they help us to cope and find meaning and a certain peace in the inhumanity still.
Oh, absolutely, man. You know, one guy that I would recommend people watch when he's drawing online, because he does it all the time, is Drew Moss. I believe he's down in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. I met him at Heroes down there years ago. And guys like Adam Gorham, he posts videos where he's inking and drawing sometimes. And Michael Walsh did a long, an all-day kind of like mini Comic-Con from his studio the other day on Instagram. And there's just something calming about hearing these particular creators for me. When I hear them talk, my writer friend Landon Faulkner down in the States, he's a truck driver, but he's also a brilliant comic writer for Head Shrinkers Press. And hearing him do a little video yesterday, it just I don't know if it's a southern accent or if he's just a charmer or what, but it just calmed me right down, you know. And watching Drew Moss, he was doodling, what was he drawing? He was drawing a Two-Face the other day, and it just watching him draw and just watching him chill, you know, it just was like, oh, it just felt good, you know. It felt for a moment normal. And yeah. So I'm hoping to do a lot more of that type of thing, and hope that I can maybe pass some of that kind of comfort on to other people, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that I think sometimes the people who are going to face these situations or deal with being in their home and isolated, they're going to have, I think, a tougher time, because some people's whole lives are simply defined by going to their job and making their money and doing that rigmarole. And they don't know how to enjoy reading a book, enjoy going to, you know, they're the type of people maybe who would go to a museum and not find any sort of peace in the creative aspect of life.
I think in general a lot of North American society has forgotten how to relax.
We've
forgotten how to let go of the stress, and actually, like, you know, that's why you see a lot of guys come home from work and hit the bottle hard, because they got to do it again tomorrow, or they hit whatever other, you know, they jump on the video games and kill a bit of time doing that, and get their aggressions out, you know, killing zombies in a video game. Because I think that we've all forgotten to relax. I know some friends of mine who recently been laid off from their work, and I think they really don't know what to do because they've never had this strange freedom thrust upon them. And I try to use the word freedom because, you know, it's I think there's a lot of – I mean, I'm sleeping a lot more. But it's not because I'm – I don't know. I feel like my body's finally like, well, you don't have anything to do tomorrow, so you can actually rest and get a full night's sleep. And I think that
– That's so important.
I think there's going to be a lot of healing happening out of that. Like I'm tired all the time, but I feel like I'm tired because I'm mentally exhausted. But when I sleep like the dead now. And I wake up and I'm like, how is it 10 o'clock and I'm just opening my eyes? Like I'm usually awake at 8 o'clock, like bright and shiny, you know, so – or earlier sometimes. And it's just weird. Like, but I think it's because, you know, we're given a – I don't think any of us have slept in 30 years.
No.
Especially with kids. Like, I don't even know how anyone with kids can manage it. Like, my hat goes off to every one of them. Like, I don't know how you guys do it. Like,
Absolutely. I have no idea. I give them a lot of respect. And it's true because sometimes there's something to be said. We have so much time on our hands. Some people, they don't know what to do with themselves. It drives them crazy. So they have to go back to work and feel that they are productive. But there's time is that luxury where now you can make a moment. Now you can make a memory with the people that you're with. Now you can, like I always say, my only regret is that I have a wonderful collection of books. I don't know if I'm ever going to get around to reading all of them, but my intention is to. So now that I have this extra time, let me enjoy these things that I have.
I'm with you. Like, I always get amazing books as gifts from people, and I'm always like, wow, this is so awesome. And then I'm like, oh, I can't believe you got me this book. I only mentioned it briefly in a conversation 6 months ago, and you remembered. And like, Erica gets me the most amazing books. And like, I don't get to sit and enjoy them. I just don't, because, you know, you put in long hours, deadlines are what they are, and, you know, you don't get your, you know, you sometimes have to push off all your chores until the weekend, and then your weekend gets eaten up by stuff, and it's just hard to find the time to sit and kill an hour reading. And I think we've come as a society to the point where for some of us, sitting down and taking an hour for yourself to read or play a video game, it creates a sense of guilt or shame.
Yep. It's like a waste of time. You wasted time. All you did was that. And it's like, no, you know what? Sometimes when you sit down and read or take in something to exercise your mind, it's as essential.
It is essential. You know, my thing that's weird, like I draw for a living. I draw all the time. But I can't tell you the last time I sat down and did a drawing just for myself, or the last time I just filled up 3 pages of a sketchbook because I just felt like noodling for a while. Because you get to a point in your career, especially if you're in a low-income situation like I am, where every time you sit down to draw, you feel like you have to monetize that time. So I want to sit down and relax and draw myself a Swamp Thing. At the back of my mind, I know someone's going to buy that Swamp Thing. So I eventually, if not today, maybe tomorrow or maybe a month from now. But I know that I'm creating something that someone down the road will buy. And that is kind of the opposite of art. You know what I mean? It's kind of the opposite of the intention of doing that drawing to begin with, which is why I was doing for a while. I was doing, and I got to get back into them. I was doing those kind of meditative landscape, alien landscape drawings before bed every night. And it was just like dumping all my stress onto a page without any sense of, you know, having to monetize that time or to turn this into a product that I can sell. Yeah. It's a hard, especially when you're freelancing and you never know when your paycheck's coming in or what you can count on. You know, you sometimes go months and months and months without a paycheck, and it's really a tough way to build a life. But you find a way, and you constantly are feeling like you have to monetize everything you do, and it's just stupid. You should just make art for art's sake, and you let whatever happens happens. But it's a privilege and a luxury, and I think now we've all been equalized, we've all been leveled to a degree where we you know, with the exception of the brave people who are still out working in the food chain supply and health and you know, transport and all these really essential things, you know, I think it's you know, it's just tough. It's a tough adjustment for sure.
Yeah. How are things going in regards to the book that you're doing with Matt Nixon, with Dodge?
Oh, it's good. It's we've had to take a bit of a long break just because of, you know, everything else going on. But we had that Kickstarter a year and a half or so ago that didn't run, wasn't successful. And we've been planning and plotting a new Kickstarter. And I've created a bunch of visual elements for the Kickstarter. And we have 2 issues finished. I have Perfect. Half the script, I think, for the next issue. And I'm working on that. There's some new characters coming, which I'm having some fun figuring out how they're going to look. And it's been going okay. I think the plan is to have a Kickstarter, I think, this month or next month. We're both just sort of waiting to see. I mean, it's simultaneously kind of the worst time to do a Kickstarter and possibly the best time to do a Kickstarter because, you know, comic shops are closed and people aren't able to get their hands on the books as easily as they were before. So maybe this is the way to go. But, you know, there's still a lot of work to do. And we were going to do a Kickstarter, I believe. We're going to kickstart the first issue. Actually, Shane Amato has been helping us, with that. He gave us a pretty good plan to follow because, as you know, Cauldron's been immensely successful for them. They always do really well on their Kickstarter. So he gave us some really good pointers that he learned the hard way, and we've applied them to our Kickstarter. And we're asking for a much smaller amount this time. We just want to, the first book is completely finished and inked and colored and lettered and everything. It's just a matter of making it, making it into a physical reality now. So, and issue two is all set to go, and issue three is on the way. So, you know, it's still happening. It's just been a choppy couple of years, and then this recent situation has really kind of thrown us for a loop. But we're both positive about it, and we're both, you know, feeling like it's going to happen. It's just, we're just kind of going day by day. But I'm happy with the drawings. I've been really That's happy. Good. I feel like I kind of found my groove in issue two because it was lots of monster fights, and the characters are becoming much more real to me. And I still want to do it. I've essentially been working for free for a long time now just to get to a point where we can get this book out. The Kickstarter will be used entirely just to pay for the printing of the book. I'm not going to take any pay until our letterer and our colorist are paid, because that's what's going to make the book look so sharp and make it into a real book. So that's the deal right now. We'll just try to get it done, and in the meantime I got some other projects I'm hopefully going to do, and I had some other covers lined up with Big Country Comics with some different publishers that I'm looking forward to working on. So time will tell.
That's good. So how do you transition, because I know that you're one of the most recognizable cover artists. Your covers are gorgeous. You capture the character that is on, that the book is about. They're always eye popping. And then you're transitioning to doing this indie book with Matt, and you're doing the sequentials in it. So how do you adjust to that? Do you find yourself, is that a challenge for you?
Oh yeah, big time. I don't pages don't come easily to me. I wish they did. I think I need to do a little bit more work around the front end, because I'm eager to get down to the inking and get down to finishing up that page. But sometimes you don't see the bad decisions you've made on a page until you've actually started putting your brush and ink down onto a thing, and then you realize, well, that's perspective's wrong, or this is wrong. And I'm not doing enough. I think I'm not doing enough of the hard work at the front end, because I essentially know what I want to do with each page, but there's a lot of information to pack into those things. And also it's weird too, like if I'm working from a script and I know what's going to happen next, trying to communicate that to the person who's reading the book who doesn't have that knowledge, because I can draw something a certain way and then realize like, oh crap, they don't know that's about to happen, or they don't know that this is the situation with this character. So there's a lot of information that you have to impart in the visuals that isn't always obvious in the text of the comic book. And so yeah, it's a big struggle for me. The other thing that I kind of get tangled up on, and this may have been what caused so many delays with the front end of Dodge, is that I really like to have a finished perfect page at the end. Like I don't like having a page that's an assembly of a bunch of different pieces of artwork, which is how most comics get made in truth. Like there's not a whole lot of, there's guys who just draw the page as a page and that's it. I like having the artwork as a secondary source of income if possible to sell those pages to collectors. But at the end of the day, the point is to get the page done and done as well as possible. And if that means I have to assemble, if it's a 9-panel page, and that means I need 9, separate drawings that I have to do and reassemble back into one layout, I mean, that's the way it's got to be. There's lots of guys who work that way. I know Casey Parsons has been doing some amazing stuff with his Cauldron books, and he's been doing it kind of like in that style, where you kind of work out out each panel. You have your page layout, but you kind of work out your panels, you know, off to the side, and then you kind of compile them back together, and then maybe you ink it all as one page. So there's lots of different ways. When I was doing books for Rubicon Publishing and Scholastic Books many years ago, I didn't have the luxury of being able to do everything all nice and pristine on one page. It very often took lots of light boxing, and sometimes a panel will be small but it has lots of information, so I'll draw it bigger so that I can condense it down. And there's lots of assembly work that goes on that the person reading the comic has no idea about. Not everyone's like a, you know, Jack Kirby or a Walter Simonson who can just sit down and draw a page exactly as it's in their head and have it come right on the page. Like, you know, a lot of artists use a different process where they'll develop everything separately, all the different panels based off of an initial layout, and then assemble them all together as panels on one page. So there's lots of different ways to do it. I'm finding the iPad Pro using Procreate has been great for penciling a book. I still like having my final inks be my own hand with a brush, but it's nice to be able to pencil on in a way digitally, so that if I, you know, you get the whole page done and you realize, oh, this character's head is too big, or, you know, I don't want to draw this gun 15 times, so I'd, you know, and then ink it 15 times, so how about I draw it one time and then copy it and move it around a few times on this page at that angle, and then create a couple different angles of guns, and then, you know, I'm still going to have to ink those 15 guns, but a gun can take 40 minutes to draw, so, you know, you're drawing a whole page of soldiers with guns, and some stuff just doesn't come easily to me. So there's a little bit of trickery that can that the digital drawing can really help with, and help speed up the front end a little bit. Yeah. So that's been pretty cool. Yeah.
It's a good learning process to that trial and error, and seeing all the different methods that can go about to make it as best as you want it to be as well. Because I know that you have that. I think that perfectionist in you, where you want it to be as beautiful as possible for the people who are going to read it. You want it to, anyone to look at it, to appreciate the effort and time that you put into what they're going to now take in. And, you know, something there's, I think you're that type of artist where people will perhaps look at things and look at all the detail because of the way you draw. Cause you got some other books that the artists are great. They're great storytellers, but sometimes their perspective or their anatomy is kind of wonky, and that's part of the appeal to it, right? You're kind of, into that look of it, but then you have someone such as yourself who you really want all of that anatomy and the way the gun functions, you want it to look as legit as possible.
Well, yeah, because there's always going to be someone who knows better than you. And if you, like, you know, if you draw something that's totally wrong, I had to draw like a Vietnam boat with a big 50 caliber machine gun on the back. And I found as much reference as I could, but I don't know if I drew it correctly. But, you know, I you know, could hear from a Vietnam vet who's like, well, I actually used that gun, and here's why yours wouldn't work, you know, based on the drawing you did of it. So, you know, there's that type of thing. I always try to be respectful to, you know, if I don't know what I'm doing, I try to, I mean, that's part of drawing a comic book too, is the research and making sure you actually know what you're talking about with your drawings, you know? So yeah, that's why I always wanted to draw like kind of Viking stuff and, you know, more barbaric stuff where I can get away with some more rudimentary builds and, you know, total lack of technology and machines, you know, that type of thing. But that's just the lazy artist in me that likes to draw, you know, monsters and that kind of thing. So,
hey man, I don't think you're alone in that. You got to know where it is that you thrive and the best of you comes out, right? It's just how it is. It's not a weakness.
And, you know, we're constantly evolving as artists too. Like I know that, I don't, you know, want to speak for him, but I know I've heard Adam Gorham in the past say that, you know, drawing comics started to get easier and better and more enjoyable for him when he started to focus on the environment instead of the figure. You know, he's already a master of the figure. He's already a master of human expression, and his body language and his figures are incredible, and his expressions, and, you know, look at the punk mambo stuff he's doing, and just everything the guy does is magic. But like he said, he told me, he's like, things really started to get better and make sense when I started to think about the environment the characters are in and making that as important or more important than the figures themselves, because someone reading a book is reading going from word bubble to word bubble. I mean, I read the book and then I go back and look at the panels because, you know, you get taken away by a story sometimes.
Yeah.
Before you know, you've read the whole graphic novel and you go, wait a minute, what did I just read? Like, the story was great, but I got to go back and look at these drawings, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good reminder to slow down and appreciate it, because, you know, that's the thing. You can spend 4 days trying to figure out how to do the perspective on a panel on the inside of a water tower or something like that, something weird you have to draw, and you know, you want to make sure it looks right, but the person reading it may not even care, and they may not know that you spent 4 days working on something that should have taken you an hour, because they're only going to give it half a second regard anyway, you know. Yeah. So it's a weird thing like that.
I really try to do that myself, when, because I read a lot and I go through stuff like you said quickly, and then I say to myself, well, wait a second, let me actually take a look at this page, because I was, you know, one of the examples is Silver Surfer Black, where Trad Moore's art, it's in this, on this, not prestige, but that treasury edition format. So it's made for you to really take in the artwork with the story. It's not just in that, that standard size. So I got it.
Trad's a genius too. I mean, if you compare that book to Luther Strode, and you see even the last issue of Luther Strode compared to the first issue of Luther Strode, you can watch this artist just transform his style. Just, I think that guy has really found what it is he wants to do. I've also had the pleasure of watching that guy draw. I watched him painting or inking a highway, high traffic highway scene, bird's eye view of like a bridge, with all these cars smashing into each other on a bridge, and he was doing it with a brush, and his hand was like it looked like one of those machine plotters that cuts out, you know, cuts vinyl. Like, it was just moving like a robot. And I was like, how are you drawing these straight lines with a brush? How are you keeping these lines consistent and perfect? Like, he just has this thing that he does, man. Trad is a wonderful human, and his artwork is just unbelievable. Yeah. But yeah, it's like the Surfer book is such a wild ride, where the artwork is just in so intrinsic with the words. Like, you know, that story couldn't have been told by a different artist, I don't think, you know.
No. And the perspective of, or sorry, the anatomy, and sometimes the perspective of stuff is stretched out, and it's
just bonkers.
Totally, but it
works, right?
Exactly. And that's why, like, going back to what you said, it's like, take a moment, take it in, and allow what the artist drew here to affect your interaction with the story, because so often you get, you know, that traditional couple panels on a page, and you're not really interacting enough with the art that is intrinsic to the story that's being told. I don't know if you've seen any of Ivan Reis's work on the Brian Michael Bendis Superman stuff.
Is it recent? I haven't got a DC comic in a long time, to be honest with you. I remember his stuff on, didn't he draw some amazing Green Lantern stuff years ago?
Yes.
Yeah.
He did Sinestro Core War. But
his
stuff in this Superman book, because he takes Superman into, you know, more of a cosmic storyline in that particular book that he's drawing, and all of the detail, it's like almost George Perez-like, where as many things he can put on that page while you see – you know, Superman flying at you through the page, you also see where he came from and all these ships in the background. And I'm like, I think I'm enjoying more of the artwork of this than anything else. I got to take a little bit of more time to appreciate what he did here instead of flying through it just to say I finished another book. Because that's sometimes what you do when you collect so much and your stockpile is at this point where you feel shameful. It's like, let me try to read as much as I can, and I'm not actually taking anything in or remembering what I read.
Well, that's it. It's like it becomes, I mean, in my case, reading and taking time for myself has become such a guilty pleasure that I think I do rush through things. Like I remember I just chewed through the entire Preacher series when I first discovered it, because it was just sort of ending when I first discovered it. And so I went back and got all the trades, and like I might as well have eaten the pages. I went through it so quickly, and like I loved it. It was to me, like, the Preacher had the most satisfying ending of any story in comics I think I've ever read. And then at the same time, I'm like, I gotta go back and read that again, because I think I literally just ate it. Like, I just ate the book. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? There is so much to enjoy about that book that I'm sure I did. Like, Steve Dillon's art is just incredible, but like, you know, just to go back and really appreciate the storytelling in that story, like, because it just takes you away. And maybe that's the success then. Maybe that's why that is such a powerful book, you know, because it just works so well. You don't even take the time to stop and look at the art because you're just in it. You're just a part of it, you know.
And some artists have said that. You know, if you just, I spent this much time drawing it, and if it took you, you know, a split second to read it and you got it, it means I did my job. And I'm like, I never thought of it that way.
I think it's a high compliment, you know. I mean, it's like, I love Mike Mignola's work. I mean, I first, you know, got into Hellboy. I couldn't get enough. I couldn't wait for it to come out again. Like, there was something about that synergy of his drawing and his writing, that like just hooked me. Like, I couldn't get enough. And I was never like a giant kind of Mignola guy. Like, I loved the Hulk covers and stuff he did when I was reading the Hulk way back when, but I never really, I don't think he was a guy that in those days I would seek out as someone that I had to get their work. Like, there were certain guys I had to get their work. But yeah, now I have such a huge appreciation for it. And it was like this weird kind of hook in me, you know, because it was so unlike any other comics out there. I can go back and read a Hellboy book anytime, and just, it feels like it's all brand new, you know, every time I read it. I just love it for that.
Yeah. I think I had that experience with G. Willow Wilson's Miss Marvel, Adrian Alfano's work, because I looked at it at first and I just said, you know, this isn't the type of artwork that I'm kind of used to from superhero books. And then as I read the story, I didn't want anybody else to draw that book other than Adrian. Because
it's 100%. Yeah. And he packed so much into those pages that you take for granted, you know, like totally. where she's talking to her father in the kitchen, just the stuff in the background, like stuff that like you don't even think about because you don't have to think about because you know you're in the kitchen. Like, there's these little devices and just whatever. Like, I love when you're just in that argument, when you're just in that room with those characters. And yeah, it's because you've been presented with a reality that's so just instantly recognizable and iconic as what it is.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you stop and actually go and focus on the details. You go, God, this guy's a genius, you know? So,
yeah, and it totally made you feel the writing, the art, yep, the texture, the kind of gangly look that she had, or the weird, yep, positioning of her fingers at times. As you're reading the book, you're like, no, this art's perfect.
Yep, it's like a Ben Temple Smith book. Like, I'm not sure if you've read a lot of Ben's Ben Temple Smith stuff, but like, you know, Ben's style is his style, and no one can touch it, and no one does anything like him, and he just does his thing, and like he doesn't make any apologies for it. I mean, if the fingers are bending weird, that's because that's how he draws fingers, man. You know what I mean? And there's no question there. There's no doubt there. It's like Mignola or those really strongly stylized artists where you just accept that, you know, yep, those are square fingers. That's cool. You know, that's, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just rambling now, but you know what I'm saying.
No, totally. I think Romita Jr. became kind of, had that sort of look in as he progressed as an artist, because you kind of see his work change from his Amazing Spider-Man stuff with Roger Stern, and then he goes on to the X-Men, and you see the figures sort of become more of that blocky type of thing, yeah, that you're used to seeing him or recognizing him for. And even now, a lot of people may criticize his work as being fast or not as rich in detail as it once was, but his storytelling, I still think, is still one of the best storytellers. The way a page moves.
Well, I kind of feel like, you're talking Romita Jr., right?
Yes, Romita Jr.
Yeah, I love his stuff, and I've loved watching it grow. I mean, if you look at the what was it, Contest of Champions? I mean, that was one of his first gigs as an inker. I think he was inking his dad's work in that book. I mean, his style obviously is, you know, he's inking and his dad, so it's a different style. But when you get into like his Daredevil years and like his weird Spider-Man years, and then like, you know, Kick-Ass to me is kind of like, I love, people criticize that book, but I love the energy of all of his drawings. I mean, it was like he didn't ink anything. Everything was just penciled and loose, but it's so expressive. And yeah, I loved it. I kind of felt like that was him finding his thing, you know? But, you know, then he came up with Superman, and everyone kind of pooped all over that. But I didn't think it was that bad, but no. I don't know.
I think everyone's expectations of someone's glory days, and then they don't like them. I mean, John Romita is to me, if you're going to imagine the Marvel Universe in your mind, he's one of those, John Romita Jr. is one of those guys who's drawn pretty much definitive versions or stories of almost every key character.
For sure he has,
in Marvel, right? Yep. He's got his X-Men run. He's got his Spider-Man run. The list goes on and on of all the things he's – his Thor. He's done a definitive – you know, so you've got all of these characters in the Marvel universe drawn – Daredevil. Just looking at my shelf now. And, and it's like
–
when he's on DC. I love
the way he did Mephisto in Daredevil. It was so different. It wasn't the John Buscema Red Devil Mephisto. It was like this weird, monstrous, dreadlocked thing, which I thought was so cool, you know?
Yeah.
Just a different slant on an iconic character. And just, yeah, I love that. I love this Daredevil stuff like that. All that Typhoid Mary stuff. It's just so – I mean, I think about that amazing Sabretooth cover where Sabretooth jumping down – I can't remember the issue. He's jumping down on Daredevil, and it's just an amazing – just I'm pretty sure that was Romita. This is probably where I'm going to get busted now. I thought that was a Romita Jr. Because the style of it was just so raw and crazy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So when you see him drawing, you know, Batman or Superman, you're like, this is weird. It's cool that it's Romita, but he's in the wrong universe. Like this isn't home, even though it's fine for him to draw whoever he wants to draw. You're just not used to it, I think.
Yeah, I get that, man. Totally. Yep.
So I didn't mind his Superman myself, but again, I'm a John Romita Jr. fan, so maybe I'm just an apologist. So,
well, that's it. I'm a John Byrne guy. I mean, a lot of people hate John Byrne, and they think his work has suffered over the years. I think he works as hard as he wants to work, and I think he does awesome stuff. I have an original of his on my wall. I think the guy is a god. Maybe his later stuff wasn't as strong as his FF years or his Man of Steel years, or even his X-Men years. But I love it all as a huge body of work, and I think. Even Simonson, I think Simonson's work on Ragnarok right now that he's doing for IDW is just sensational. I mean, it's all him. It's just honest and pure, and maybe it's a little different than his Thor years or the FF years or the other things that he drew, but I just love it because it's just him. It's just an extension of what he's always done. It's just, you know, maybe he's a little more comfortable and just doing things the way he wants to now. He doesn't have a Marvel editor telling him to do it a certain way, you know?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I love – that's another guy too, like –
oh,
his Thor, even his Orion. I don't know if you read his Orion.
So good, man. I know.
Too definitive, and I love how there's a lot of similar themes between those two universes because the fourth world was supposed to be an extension of the realm, the nine realms, and Asgard, and all that stuff. So I love that he was able to play in both of those universes. His work is just gorgeous. I love it.
Oh yeah. Have you been reading Ragnarok?
I haven't read the new stuff, but I'll definitely get around to collecting that at some point because I love Simonson on Thor. I think is I don't know if Kirby and Lee are more definitive than what Simonson is known for with that character. It's very hard to say that, but
yeah, like I see what you're saying. For me, Simonson is the most definitive Thor creator, in my opinion. I mean, obviously, I love what Kirby and Stan did for sure. Like, you can't take anything away from that. But I think Bitter A Bill dropped everybody on their head. You know what I mean? And everyone was like, "What's this?" You know? And he just. It was just so good. It was so fresh. It was so exciting. And I was a little kid reading that, and it was just like, this is unbelievable. You know, just really took me away. It's my favorite run of Thor, although a very close second is Jason Aaron's run. That whole epic story, he just spent the last, since about 2012 telling 2011 incredible. He's been on Thor.
Yeah.
That's a long time, and he's done amazing things with this story. It's over now, and Donnie Cates has got it now, but I actually welled up reading the end of his run on King Thor. His farewell to the fans was one of the most heartfelt things I'd ever read. I'm sitting there reading it with tears in my eyes going, man, like this guy really got it. You know, he really got it. And I would put his Thor up against Simonson's in a contest anytime. You know, they're both so –
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking about that. I just finished that yesterday. I got the trade. And I just finished that King Thor yesterday, as a matter of fact. And I said, this guy really, he did something incredible here.
Oh yeah, for a character. And there was, you know, like I was along for most of the ride. I did take some breaks. Like I think I got about 8 or 9 issues into the Jane Foster story, and I loved it. I think I just kind of ran out of money around that time, and I stopped collecting everything for about 6 months, and then it was kind of hard to get back. And then I was only getting Unworthy Thor, and I found the resolution of Unworthy Thor to be it really turned me off. Like the big reveal of what Nick Fury's whisper was. I don't know why, but it didn't work for me. But now that I've seen how he's finished his entire arc, now I look back and I go, okay, now I know why he did that, and it makes sense to me. But at the time, I was like, that's ridiculous, and I was super mad about it. But yeah, he introduced, you know, Gore the God Butcher, who's such an incredible character, such a well-rounded, wonderful villain. And yeah, man, what an epic run it was. And all the artwork, I mean, the Mike Del Mundo bits were incredible. I didn't care for the story at that time. I didn't care for the whole War of the Realms and Thor having 500 different hammers and all that stuff. I didn't really get into a whole bunch of that. I bought it for the Del Mundo work at that point, because I love his stuff. It's just so crazy. I love his real world stuff. I can go on about Del Mundo all day. But Thor's been in some really, really powerful hands of creators over the years, for sure.
Yeah. Del Mundo is one of those artists that, like before, I wasn't onto him so quick, because when he did his Avengers stuff, I found it hard to follow the story. His artwork, yeah. I didn't realize how much of his covers I absolutely loved, and I would have some of his hip-hop variants hanging on my wall because I loved how he's a hip-hop fan himself, so he combined it. Mm-hmm. He got the essence of the album and the character that was being blended with it. I just absolutely loved it. But then his storytelling, his sequentials, I couldn't keep up with as well. But when he did Thor, and I just allowed myself to, he really adapted the essence of that world that Jason Aaron was in that part of the story. And I felt like his art, I got it. I figured it out, and it resonated with me. I just
sure, yeah. I loved the work. I just couldn't. I don't know. Like Thor had gone through so many changes at this point, and I guess there's always the purist in me is always waiting for Thor to get Mjolnir back.
Yeah.
And I don't even have the issue where I think I had to drop again. I was during a low tide, we'll say, in my finances. I wasn't able to get my monthlies, and for a long time, I missed out a lot of those stories. But when I knew that Jason Aaron was wrapping up on King Thor, I loved King Thor. I love that idea that Thor, thousands of years from now, is still the last, you know, the last surviving god in the universe. And I loved his take on that character, the missing arm, all of that stuff. It was just wonderful. So, you know, but yeah, Del Mundo, my favorite Del Mundo work was actually what he did on Weird World. I love that little series with, you know, Archon, and I love that character from the 70s, like from the Marvel 2-in-1 books and Fantastic Four and stuff. But I don't know what it was. That book was so weird and cool, and like it just brought these old weird characters back into it, like Crystar, like from the action figure series. Crystar shows up in that series, and Jason Aaron was writing that too. Just unbelievable, you know.
Yeah.
super cool. His style works so well at digital. He's like a master of the digital style.
Yeah, and it feels painted. There's a nice texture to it.
It's detailed
but also like whimsical. I don't know how to describe it.
It's so light and it's so colorful, and yet it's so well established. And yeah, man, I just love his stuff. Really good stuff.
So I asked you to come up with some top five lists of your own choosing. Were you able to come up with some stuff?
Yeah, like I was thinking about it. It's kind of tough. Like it's almost like when it comes to TV shows and stuff like that, I'd have to rank them almost per decade, you know. But if I had to give an overall, like. See, I have weird little nuggets of TV shows that stick out in my head as being super important to me. Like, I think, without question, my number one all-time favorite show is The Simpsons, just because I feel like in many ways The Simpsons is the closest thing I've ever had to church in my life. My wife and I can have a conversation in pure Simpsons quotes and completely understand what each other is saying. You know, The Simpsons is just ingrained in me, and there's, you know, we've been rewatching. My brother-in-law got me all the DVDs of the original. You know, the first, like, I think the first 12 or 15 seasons or something. We've been watching those, and man, there's just some gold in there. And so that's probably my favorite all-time show. But ranking underneath that is tough, because it's like I almost want to group cartoons into one, and then group, you know, like sitcoms into another. It's really tough. So yeah, I don't know. Like I'd say, Simpsons, Thunder the Barbarian for sure is a huge cartoon in my personal mythology. I really, really bonded with those characters when I was a kid. I was 6 years old in 1981, and Thunder was on in the morning, and man, that was like it was a mix of Star Wars and Conan the Barbarian. It was a ruined world in 1996. You know, it was pure unbridled fantasy, and then I found out as an adult that, you know, guys like Alex Toth and Jack Kirby had a huge hand in creating that world. And it's so no cool. surprise, like, looking back on it. Mm-hmm. Man, so good. Such an important cartoon. Thundercats was huge for me. G.I. Joe. Those two were played back to back when I was in grade 4 and 5. So that was, like, a huge part of my daily ritual. And then Samurai Jack. I love Samurai Jack for the story, like, the story and the style. And then recently I watched another Genndy Tartakovsky book. I probably said his name wrong. Primal. I'm not sure if you've checked out Primal.
No, I haven't.
It's his kind of like caveman meets T-Rex and they become friends, kind of like it's completely wordless, six-part cartoon.
Really?
Where in this fictional time that didn't exist, where cavemen and dinosaurs walk together on the earth. But dude, it is like every episode left me in tears. Every episode got me so pumped and excited. The style of the artwork, I would highly recommend Primal. If you haven't seen it, it's you got to see it.
Well, you can get it on
iTunes, I think.
Okay.
I think there's only been, I think, 5 or 6 episodes. I don't know if there's more coming. I hope there is. But, oh, my God, just took me away.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, that'd be my top 5 cartoons probably.
Okay.
But Simpsons would probably rank number 1 of all shows combined, you know. One show that weirdly sticks out for me, just to get a little bit of nerd fact in there, when we didn't get WCW or NWA wrestling in Canada very often or at all in the late 80s. And there was a weird little show. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. There was a weird little show that came on called Learning the Ropes, which maybe you don't remember it, maybe you mm-hmm. do. It ran for one season on CTV between like September of 88 and March of 89. And the reason I watched it was because it was a sitcom starring Lyle Alzado, the football star, where he played a pro wrestler who was also like, I think he's like a school teacher or something, or a coach at a high school. And it was about him being a single dad and having kids and raising these two kids. And at night he played a pro wrestler called the Masked Marauder. And the reason I watched the show was because it was my only access to WCW and NWA wrestling stars, like the Road Warriors. The first time I ever saw the Road Warriors, Legion of Doom, was on that show. And you know, in the show, like Hawk bites the top of a beer bottle off and drinks his beer that way, and like, you know, he wrestles Ric Flair in the show, and all the in-ring cuts was actually Dr. Death Steve Williams under a mask because they had a similar build.
Oh,
and so
cool.
it was all Dr. Death doing the wrestling moves against the Road Warriors or Terry Taylor or all these, you know, Ronnie Garvin, all these old like NWA stars, which I had been reading about for years because like we only had wrestling magazines, black and white wrestling magazines,
yep.
like Pro Wrestling Illustrated and The Wrestler,
yep.
to follow up on those stars because we just didn't get those channels. And so I watched that show religiously, and I would watch the repeats over and over again because there'd be 4 minutes at the end of the show or halfway through the show where the Masked Marauder was wrestling Ric Flair, or you know, Lex Luger would show up and put someone in the torture rack, and it was like it was magic. And then it was shortly after that time that Flair would eventually, we started to get WCW on TV. I think I had to stay up until like 3:05 in the morning to watch it on TBS or something like that, but I would stay up and watch it. And
that's hilarious.
That was a show that I loved, and it only ever ran one season. Unsurprisingly, it was a terrible show. I tried to watch it again, and it was painful. But the bits with the wrestlers were so good, and so I loved it. And Lyle Alzado, I remember, I don't know if you remember him, but he'd show up on commercials all the time on Canadian television. I think he may have played in the CFL, but I'm certain he was an NFL guy as well. But yeah, I don't know why that show sticks out as being one of my favorite shows, because it was just this weird little show that I felt like it was made just for me. You know,
it's those Easter egg shows, right? It's those things that we're watching it specifically for that Easter egg of the wrestlers that you want to. So
that's
you'll,
it.
You know,
that's
you, it. You ignored all of the nonsense of whatever the show was outside of the wrestling, but you really wanted to see the WCW guys that were in those. I remember those magazines. My cousin used to have a bunch of them. And even though they were old, you would still see like the old at the back of the page, the top 10 rankings. And you had,
oh man, the it was top so 10 good. Was the best.
Right. It was so, and I never knew how they, where they came up with these lists for, you know, the number one contender or whatever the case was. But I just love looking at that and studying those old lists and seeing what the match results were in different cities and towns.
Yeah, it was so fun. I would love the match results. Like, I remember reading the Japan ones. Like, I was like, what? They went to Japan. And it'd be like, you know, Jinichiro Tenryu defeated Randy Savage with a power bomb. And I'm like, no way. And like, what happened? Like, oh, Stan Hansen defeated so-and-so with the lariat at 7 minutes and 35 seconds. And I'm like, what? They had a match together? Because Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody and all these guys were like weird, like fictional characters to me. They were like these strange, like icons. Because, yeah, you'd see them in black and white in the magazines and I'd read about them. And they always seemed so much cooler than what WWE was made available. And I used to watch Stampede Wrestling too. And they had great characters in that too. Like, I love the Blackhearts. They were a great tag team. Weirdly enough, one of the Blackhearts years later would friend me on Facebook. And turns out he's a giant Conan fan. He actually has a ton of my Conan artwork. So I used to watch him wrestle against, you know, Chris Benoit and Biff Wellington when they were like just teenagers getting in the ring. And, you know, young Owen Hart as the world champion and Bad News Allen, better known as Bad News Brown, as the main bad guy in Stampede. And oh my God, it was so, so awesome. And I would consume all the wrestling I could at that age, but I didn't get any. We'd watch AWA. AWA would come on sometimes and I'd see some familiar faces on that. The Sheik would go there. Different guys would go there. And I loved AWA for its programming. They got poached by they all ended up going to Vince, but like there was some really great stuff, really cool concept matches that they had and cool like tournament concepts that they would create. They had this one thing in AWA that was just like this weird point system where there was like, random teams assembled and they had like a different color code, and like every week you'd see this ranking, this round robin ranking happening, and you'd have like these weird matchups. Like Sergeant Slaughter would, you know, fight someone that's normally his friend, like, you know, Greg Gagne or something, and it's really, really cool stuff. I couldn't get enough wrestling in those days. So yeah, that's why learning the ropes was, even though it only gave me like 3.5 minutes of access to it, it was worth staying up for, you know?
Yeah, for absolutely. Sure. I remember watching when I was a kid, Boy Meets World, one of the characters, his father was Big Van Vader. I thought that was hilarious that he would show up on this show as the kid's dad. And the kids would have to do like a high school match to try to defeat him. But that Easter egg of seeing a wrestler on there was just a thrill. It's so true.
Oh, yeah. So good, man. Vader was such an unstoppable monster. I remember the first time I saw him wrestle ever was there was a huge WCW pay-per-view event in Japan. I think it was like 90. I want to say it was like 1991. And it was called, I think, like the WCW Japan Super Show. And it had like the Steiner brothers fought, like, Kensuke Sasaki Hase and Muda fought Sting, and Tatsumi Fujinami fought Ric Flair, and they had a match, and it was like a no holds barred style match, and it was Vader versus Stan Hansen. And I'd only read about these guys for years, and seeing them both in the flesh wrestling each other, and I mean, they were stiff. Like at one point, Hansen literally punches Vader's eyeball out of his head, Vader has to push his eyeball back into his head. And I remember my older brother watching it, and we were just like, we couldn't believe the violence and like the crazy backdrop neck suplexes that the Japanese style was famous for, the hard chops and the hard impact suplexes. And man, that show blew my head apart. And then I couldn't get enough information on Japan, and thankfully Pro Wrestling Illustrated always covered a little bit of what was happening in Japan. And so good.
I love those magazines. Like, I remember some of those old ones from the 80s. They would show, you know, the Road Warriors. They weren't Legion of Doom yet. They were the Road Warriors in scaffold matches. And
it just was like, so crazy.
Yeah, you'd be like, they had a scaffold match? Like, what the heck is that? And
yeah, it was the first time I saw Yushin Thunder Liger. He showed up and he fought Flying Brian, and that blew me away. I'd never seen anything like Liger before, you know, just so incredible.
Yeah, so good. Are you still keeping up? Are you still keeping up with wrestling these days?
I read about it here and there. I'll be honest with you. I haven't consumed – I've kind of taken a bit of a strong stance against WWE, not because I have a problem with their talent. They have amazing, talented people, and I think this – I think finally putting the belt, the world title situation, giving it to Drew McIntyre is such a good decision now. It wouldn't have been a good decision when they wanted to 10 years ago, but that guy has grown and become such an incredible athlete in the decade since they first kind of discovered him there. And I think that's wonderful. I love Bray Wyatt. I have a huge affinity for the whole Wyndham Rotundo family, though. Like Barry Wyndham would be on my wrestling Rushmore for sure.
Oh yeah,
I was a massive Barry Wyndham fan, even though he never really got a fair shake. You know, he only had a hot second where he was the world champion, and that's partially because Ric Flair kind of screwed him when he went to WWE with the belt. A lot of stuff happened there that kind of ruined Barry's chance. But yeah, man, we got robbed of some great matches that could have been. Like, I would have loved to have seen Barry Wyndham in his heyday wrestle against Bret Hart, who was in his heyday at the same time. I think that would have been a match for the ages that we never got to see. And you know, there's a yeah man there's just sort of lost track what I was talking about there, but yeah, there's a
no, you're saying you're WWE
right now, and there's some great talent, but I have a problem with WWE because of their affiliation with these shows they're doing over in Saudi Arabia. I have a real problem with that, with the content of those shows and the unwriting of history that they're doing there. I just don't like it. I think it's wrong. I think it's morally corrupt, and so I haven't supported the WWE for a long time now. But I still read about the guys who are doing it. I still follow up. I love AEW. What I've seen of it is so good. I love Chris Jericho. I'll follow Chris Jericho right into hell. I've always been a Dustin Rhodes fan, so seeing him have a nice twilight with this league is fantastic. Cody Rhodes is fantastic. The talent in that league is great. I love that they got Matt Hardy now. There's some really, really cool stuff happening. It was so cool to see Jake Roberts in the ring again. It was so cool to see DDP in the ring again, like literally in the ring wrestling. That kind of blew my mind. You know, 63 years old, and look at the shape he's in, you know. And so I follow a little bit of the Japanese stuff, but honestly, I haven't. I'd be lying if I said I've been really truly following it. I love Bray Wyatt. I love the whole Fiend gimmick. I think it's an unbelievable tragedy that they gave the belt to Goldberg in that situation. I think that's terrible, but that's just me. I don't know. I'm really loving the indie stuff that I'm seeing, though. I follow a lot of indie wrestlers on Instagram, and I love what they're doing. I wish I could say I was following it more closely, but I just haven't. It's kind of had a bad taste in my mouth for WWE for a long time now.
Yeah. I think if I could be mistaken, but I think WWE right now on their website, you can pick up all of their old pay-per-views right now for free. Just stream them.
Really? Wow.
I don't know if that would interest you to just go back into the glory days.
On the network, or is that?
I think it's from the network, but from the website. So I don't think you have to be on the network right now to get access to it. I could be wrong. You might want to check it out for yourself. But yeah, for me, I'm a 90s, early 2000s kind of guy. So the stuff that from my childhood, WrestleMania 1 till, you know, 20 is my jam. I haven't really kept up that well with everything else after that. But watching some of those old SummerSlams and stuff like that, I can...
Man, it's cool. The first SummerSlam is still so amazing. When you watch that crazy big tag team SummerSlam match, and you look at what, like, every team pretty much gives the Conquistadors their finishing hold, and somehow the Conquistadors are the last team left with Powers of Pain. There is some stuff in that match that, like, there's even the main event of the SummerSlam with the Hogan and, you know, Hogan and Savage and those guys against, like, the Heenan family. Like, oh my God, what a match.
Yeah.
And, you know, WWE was wonderful, and I was lucky enough to see many live events growing up. We would go over to Buffalo or to Niagara Falls, New York, my good friend Greg Eberle and I, who you'll see wandering around Comic Cons as Negan nowadays. He does like the best Negan I've ever seen. He's my old dear friend, and we were just wrestling. We were going to be the next Legion of Doom when we were in high school. That was the plan anyway. he actually did wrestle pro for a short time. He trained with some of the Hearts, and he actually did a little bit of pro wrestling as the American Mercenary. That was his gimmick. And it was good fun. Sort of losing track there again, but no problem. My phone keeps on ringing. There's someone who's desperately trying to get a hold of me, but I'm going to let them hang for a while. What were we saying again? Sorry, I lost my train of thought. No
problem. We were just waxing rhapsodic about all of our wrestling memories, and you were saying about your friend who you guys were going to be the next Legion of Doom.
So we'd see a lot of WWE stuff, and we saw some stuff that we thought was history making, but we weren't smart to the business back then. But like, I watched Roddy Piper as Intercontinental Champ wrestle Ric Flair, who was world champ, in a steel cage. We had front row seats, and it was a steel cage match, and Piper won. And Piper, for a moment, had both belts in his hands, and he fell back into us with belts, holding the belts.
Come on.
And there was no picture taken. But there was Piper with the world title and the Intercontinental title, and we watched it happen live in little Niagara Falls, New York, in a little tiny venue, Rich Stadium or something like that. I can't remember what it was. And we could not believe it. We were on cloud nine all the way home. And then when we read the dirt sheet the next day, it was like, well, it was actually not for the world title. It was just for the Intercontinental title, which was goofy, of course. But we got to see it. We got to see Ric Flair bleed in person and lose to Roddy Piper. I think on the same card we saw I feel like we saw like the Berserker fight Bulldog. We saw just some wicked stuff. My first ever wrestling live event, just seeing the ring before any wrestlers got into it, just as we got there early and we had good seats, and just watching the arena fill up and looking at that iconic blue and gold ring, you know, waiting for these wrestlers to come down. And the main event of that event in particular was heel Jake Roberts versus Randy Savage. And it was the most epic match, and Savage beat him clean with a flying elbow. And it was just the most, like, I couldn't believe I was watching it. Like, I just couldn't believe it was real. Yeah. Wrestling was a real big part of my life. So, I wish I still had the same feelings or the same connections to it as I did back then. 'Cause it was a real passion for me.
Yeah. When I watch the old stuff, it brings me back. I it's on TV sometimes, and I turn it on and I'm like, it just doesn't have, I'm not connected anymore to it. But if I see some old footage, especially knowing all of the behind the scenes stuff, like, there's nothing quite like listening to Bruce Pritchard talk about, you know, the build up to some of their rivalries or some of the things that were happening backstage, and how they came up with the gimmick of Ted DiBiase, and how essentially it was just Vince McMahon as a wrestler is basically what they did. And I was like, that's so cool. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
Super rad. Yeah, I know. So good. So good. I could talk wrestling all day. We should do one of these just about wrestling one day.
Yeah, we should. My intention is to get you and Sean Daly together and just go back and forth. Because he's a huge – and I don't know if you've ever met – I mentioned it to Sean Daly too, but the sales director – VP of sales for Valiant Comics, Matthew Klein. He shows up at the Fan Expo every couple of years, but he's a huge wrestling mark. And I had him on the show to talk about, you know, some Bloodshot books and some of the things that are happening at Valiant right now. And I took the first little bit to ask him some wrestling questions, and we spent most of our conversation talking about wrestling, because once he started, he couldn't stop. So if I could get the three of you guys in a room going at it, and everybody's their sweet spots of that moment where they, like, you're describing the Roddy Piper moment with the two belts. And when I spoke to Sean, he was talking about being at WrestleMania 18 and never experiencing electricity in a room with all those, that moment of Hulk and The Rock.
I was there too. Yeah. And there was nothing in my life has ever measured up to that kind of magic.
Right. It was something special. I was there as well.
There was something about it, man. There was just something about it. And I mean, you know, for better or worse, for all of his many sins and whatever, Hulk Hogan was just such an important figure in the sport, and he had a particular love for him in Canada. I remember the episode of Raw that followed WrestleMania, and it was in Montreal, and Hogan walks out to the ring, and the fans gave him so much love that he couldn't even start talking because he was just standing in the ring crying.
Yeah.
And it's just the most incredible thing. And I think the people in Montreal love Hogan so much because he laid down he did the job for Jacques Rougeau. No one expected that. You know, Hollywood Hogan in Montreal was pinned clean in the ring by Jacques Rougeau, Montreal's greatest hero. And I think I think Hogan won Montreal's heart. You know, if he didn't already have it, he won it that day by giving that moment to Jacques Rougeau. Just an incredible, incredible match. And just that Hogan and Rock thing, man. Oh, yeah, that was, I never had a wrestling experience quite like that. My friend Greg, who I mentioned earlier, he was at WrestleMania 6. He was there for Hogan and Warrior. And I remember him calling me before he got on the bus to come home and from Toronto, because there was no cell phones back then. Mm-hmm. And he was just heartbroken, just crushed. But he told me how the match ended, and we both were emotional on the phone. Like, it was a big deal that Hogan got pinned clean in the ring. We hadn't seen anything like that, you know. It was pretty crazy. So, yeah. Yeah, man, it was something else for sure.
Yeah, it was the same thing when he came for night. I don't know if you remember the Nitro episode, the first one ever in Toronto, when the thing that people remember most is Bret Hart calling out Eric Bischoff, and then Goldberg comes out and gives him the spear. He's got the steel plate in his thing underneath. I was there for that too. I had floor seats, but I'll never forget. Hogan was supposed to be a heel at the time, and everything changed with his character at that point because the fans cheered him so much that he had to go back and do the pose down. He had to do the you remember that?
I remember when it changed, when they had Hogan as Hollywood Hogan, the villain, going up against hero Ric Flair in a steel cage match.
Yep.
And in the match, Hogan kicks out of a move, and the initial rumblings of Hulkamania awaken, right. And the fans all just kind of raise their eyebrows like, what? And the match started with Hogan as a heel and Flair as a face, and it ended completely flipped, because the minute people saw an inkling of Hulkamania coming back, that was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
Exactly.
And then they had no choice but to go in that direction, you know, because it was that powerful. It was that iconic to us. We believed that shit, you know? We believed it, you know? Yeah. So it was so good.
Comic books that were alive. That's what wrestling was like for me. Real life comic
books. That's it, man.
Yeah.
Costumes and good versus evil. Yeah. And I've always felt that wrestling and comic books walked hand in hand. So you can imagine how much I was in love. My favorite comic book of all time was The Thing, the Ben Grimm solo series, because he spends the last like 15 issues of that as the world champ, like literally wrestling in a super pro wrestling league. And like, that was like a perfect collision of worlds for me, you know. Yeah. My favorite character doing my favorite thing.
Who wrote that? Who was doing that series at the time?
I'm not sure if I know Byrne wrote a lot of those. I know that Ron Wilson penciled pretty much all of it, or inked pretty much that entire series. Ron was such a huge wrestling fan. For all I know, he was writing it too at that time. I'd have to go, you know, it's funny. I don't think at the time I paid much attention to who was writing those books, but I have to assume it was, it was one of those guys. I know Byrne wrote quite a bit of it. I guess that's something I'll have to do a little research on.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up too.
I only really remembered the artist's names in those days.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Let's wrap it up. You've given me so much of your time. I hope I didn't get into your dinner time with your wife.
Oh,
thank you so much.
No, man. We're good. We're good. We're just sitting here doing our thing. So I've been kind of drawing the whole time. So it's all good, man. Yeah, it's always great chatting with you.
That's good. Well, we got to do this again, because it's been over 100 episodes that I did without having a Mike Ruth on. And we can't.
Right? Wow.
Yeah, it's been about that much. And we can't let that much time go by. So we got to do this more frequently and have, again, a whole wrestling conversation. I'll get your favorite SummerSlam matches, favorite WrestleMania matches, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, man. You mentioned earlier, I just wanted to touch base. You mentioned earlier that you had an interview with Kevin Boyd.
Yes.
And it was actually your interview with him. I was like, oh, you know, I like both these guys. I'll listen to this interview. And when Kevin was going over the programming and he announced that on the Sunday, Mike Ruth versus Mark Teixeira versus Rags Morales, I literally did a spit take in my studio. I spat a mouthful of coffee across the room because I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And that was the first I'd heard of it, right? So that kind of blew me away. So the next day, of course, the show was canceled, which was just a heartbreaker. But hopefully Fan Expo will happen. I mean, maybe it'll happen. And if it does, maybe we can have the match that never was.
Absolutely. I was that when he gave me the program for what was to look forward to. And I said, oh, that's a heavyweight the triple threat match right now. And I was so looking forward to that sketch duel. So
I really hope. You know, Tex is such a great guy. He's such a hoot to be around. You know, we've had a great many conversations, and he can talk about anything with that guy. And Rags Morales, I didn't know much about him except I loved his drawings. But I met him in Saskatoon in October, and October, I guess. And what an awesome, awesome guy! Like, there's a guy you'd want to get on your show for sure, Eric. He's a really interesting dude.
Me and Martin actually got to interview him in person at the Hamilton Comic Con. Yeah, he was very gracious. It was very nice talking to him.
Yeah, what a sweet guy.
I'd like to get him again for sure. Yeah. Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it so much. It was nice to be able to chit chat and it's nice being able to touch base with everybody that I was hoping to see at the show. But you know what? We got to spend some quality time, and you know, everyone at home or who still has to go to work, we give them some content and good conversation. So I think people will enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure, man. I've loved every minute of this. We can do this anytime you want.
Awesome. Say hi to your lovely wife, and I hope you guys stay safe and healthy.
You too, brother. Take care. All right. All the best.
All the best, Mike.